This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, thank you very much, David, and hello, and can I add my welcome to you to the National Museum. This is going to be a very different session to the one I thought I was going to do when David first invited me to speak. I had planned to deliver something a bit more formal. And then I realised that actually the size of this gathering means that we can do something much more informal and I hope a bit more useful. So you'll notice I've come up without any notes at all, and that's because I'm winging it. And I'm winging it because I want you... I don't believe in we National Museum experts hectoring, lecturing and basically wagging our fingers at you and telling you what you should be doing. I see our role very much as supporting and advising and helping. So I'm going to put the onus on you to help me along here, folks. And we've got, and this is being recorded. Excuse the formality of me standing behind this podium, but it's being recorded. And your words, too, will be recorded. So I hope that between us we might have a dialogue which will not only be of interest and enjoyment to us, but might also help our colleagues who aren't here today. David has been extremely prescient in putting this up, though. This is great. And I'd forgotten that Claire had interviewed me, and I recall that interview now. And it was the day after we had a school holiday program in the bay window where we'd just eaten our lunch. And there was a group of four-year-olds, and I did indeed elicit that insight from them. And it's true, isn't it? Look at the last line there, talking about knowledge and understanding and interpretation. And it's true for four-year-olds, but it's also true for 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, the people that you're dealing with. And it's true for us. Because all of us, I think, share a fundamental interest and attitude towards the past, and that is that it's important, that it matters to us, and it matters that we understand it, and it matters that we share our knowledge and particularly share our insights into it. And that seems to me to be a good text for the dialogue that I hope will happen in the next... How long have we got? Oh, is that all? Okay. Well, still, that's good. And now, it seems to me that David structured this day very astutely because you've had a talk from Kirsten Wayner earlier today who talked, and I wasn't here to hear it, but I'm sure talked about Australian journeys and talked about the way in which the museum's collection can spark questions and exploration of Australia's history. The focus of the Centre for Historical Research, it isn't so much into the galleries or towards the collection. A bit of it is. But largely our focus is directed outwards from the museum into what I'll call the community, but a community which is divided into various sectors. We publish in academic forums. We write popular history. We get involved in all sorts of means of disseminating historical understanding. And one of the most important means, certainly what I regard as one of the most important means, is yourselves. Because it seems to me that the museum, and David exemplifies this, the museum has a very strong and legitimate and valuable role in supporting educators, in bringing students to an understanding of not just what happened in history, but how history happened, why it's important, and how they can take a part in generating more and interpretations of their own. So what I wanted to do today is to begin that dialogue and ask you what you think are hot topics. What are the things that you and your students are interested in that we in the museum can support you by suggesting sources or suggesting or refining questions or by being a part of that venture for you and your students? So I'm deliberately trying to pull back from me telling you, this is what I think is important in Australian history. I could do that, but frankly, I don't think that would be as valuable as you telling me and each other what you think are the hot topics, what are the burning questions, what are the areas that you're interested in and what your students are interested in. As a reserve, I've got some stories to tell you, but let's start the dialogue. Can we have a microphone, please? Here we go. Oh, he's doing it himself. What a humble person he is. Right. Okay, and please introduce yourselves because...
Yep, Leonie Atkinson, Wagga High. This may or may not answer your question, but it's a request / problem / thing that drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
My kids, I don't know if anybody else is having the same experience, they're most interested in finding or investigating the media interpretations of historical events. Uh-huh. And the influence of the media in popular perceptions of history.
Right. And why does that drive you nuts?
Well,
I mean, I think I know, but please tell us.
I then end up with a really general discussion of the media or a movie or whatever and its interpretation, alleged interpretation of an historical event.
Yeah.
And I was having a discussion this morning about the word scholarly. And it's trying to get my kids to realise the scholarly nature of history as a discipline that, yep, is popular history, and that's the whole extension history question of the role of history, who owns history, you know, history and identity and all of that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But trying to get kids, or trying to get 16, 17, 18-year-olds to understand the complexity of the term popular
yep.
and the term the media. So as far as their differentiated historical empathy, so mm-hmm. as far as realising that popular isn't just the people, that within popular there is a dichotomy.
Yep.
So your job
yeah.
is to... I do not know how you could do it, but yeah. that concept of popular history, a thing, a magic thing, to get kids to realise or to understand or explore the dichotomy of society when they're yeah. talking about history. And I've used a lot of little quote marks, which yeah. also annoys me.
Yeah.
But I'm
we
using,
understand.
I'm using the words that they use.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a point for discussion.
Absolutely. Look, thank you for plunging in on that, because I would share that concern. It seems to me that and I'd be interested in other people's views, but it seems to me that asking students to address things like popular perception and media representations is starting at the very hardest end of the spectrum. And it's difficult enough for proficient people to do it. Asking aspiring historians to do it strikes me as either setting them up for failure or making your lives difficult, and certainly making their lives difficult. And perhaps the best students might come up with some interesting insights. This morning it just happens that I spent an hour or two with a teacher from Melba Copeland High School in Canberra, and an extension history student who was interested in, and this sits on my shoulder and dogs me like the old man of the sea, the Battle for Australia thing. And she wanted to talk about popular perceptions of the Battle for Australia. And we were able to focus it down so that she was able to do it in a way that enabled her to do it in 2,000 words for this international baccalaureate. But I was conscious of exactly that problem, that it was setting her up for an enormous, or for something that's so fluffy and imprecise that she's doing herself a disservice by doing it. Does anyone else?
A kid last year wanted to submit popular perceptions of pirates versus the historical reality.
Okay. Yeah, and it's doable. It's a great book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But to do it for a Year 12 student, presumably, and you know this better than I do, how much help in focusing that question do they need? Yeah.
So, yeah, in question.
Yeah. Mind you, it is worth doing, and defined in the right way and supported by pointing... I don't know how much support you think students deserve or get or need, but pointed in the right direction, presumably it could be done, but there are so many pitfalls on either side of that very narrow ridge that you wonder whether it's worth doing.
I'm also seeing some sort of display, something about the media and breaking that down. So we talk, even within newspapers, there's tabloid newspapers, there's broadsheet newspapers.
Yeah.
What are their agendas, their commercial entities? And so, you know, some newspapers, their objective is to push units, to sell units, but and that gets you then back to popular, public. And then you've got the TV media. So again, you've got commercial news, you've got ABC News, you've got...
Yeah. And all this we take for granted almost. I mean, we look at the Daily Telegraph and understand the agenda behind it, but it needs a degree of understanding before any given student can analyse it in the same sort of level of sophistication, doesn't it? Thank you for that. Was there another hand going up somewhere over here, or was that just a scratching? Ben, go on. It's the only person's name I know, so I have to pick on him.
You talked about it before. It's about narrowing down their ideas.
Mm.
And this year I'm really struggling with having 16 kids and been able to help them on 16 fields of expertise that I'm not really an expert in.
Yeah.
So it's about trying to find mentors in the community and in cultural institutions to help these kids is my biggest problem at the moment.
Yeah.
And like when you do research, you've got a network of people that you, you know, touch on. These kids haven't got that network, so it's about, as a teacher, facilitating that network.
Yeah.
So if you've got any hints or tips into how to, you know, get in touch with that network or, you know, join yourself onto a university or something just to get them started. And we don't have, like, a state library or anything down where we are.
Yeah.
So we've got... Yep. I've got my librarians working really hard, but it just makes it difficult.
Thank you. Look, that's a really... You're absolutely right. When I embark on a new field of research, and I have in the last year, I'm writing a book about the Victorian bushfires, and I'm finding that I'm either going to people and saying, I'm new to this field, can you help me? Or they're coming to me and saying, oh, you're working on the bushfires, I've already done this. And you soon develop a pool of advice you can draw on. It seems to me, and obviously your people need the same thing, but of course these days we are more fortunate in that that expertise is more accessible than ever before. And of course it's accessible by sending an email. And I would encourage all of you to encourage all of your students to write to anyone they think could help. And the reason I say that is you may get knockbacks. You might get people who, scholars who are offended by the fact that a 17-year-old kid from Ulla Dulla would dare to approach them. But actually, I think most scholars are only too delighted, especially if the letter begins with, or the email begins, I read your book and I thought it was really good. And, people fall for the most pathetic flattery. I know I do. So, and I also indulge in it too. But that seems to me to be a route that is open to us now that wasn't open to us 10 years ago. And I would... I mean, you don't want any given student firing off 15 emails to the 15 people in their bibliography. They need to refine that too, figure out who the most likely person, you know, who exemplifies the argument, who's most likely to be amenable to advice. But the point is it can be done, and it can eliminate that problem of distance. I mean, I'm deeply sympathetic to people who don't live in Canberra for all sorts of reasons, not least because we've got access to collections and to people that simply isn't available to 95% of Australia. Even in Sydney, if you live on the North Shore, going to the Mitchell Library is something that family may never have done before. So it's not necessarily something that anyone can just do. But you guys are in a position where you can say to your, to the students that you know, why don't you go and look and find out who these people are? For goodness sake, these kids can find people's email addresses like that. And then, they may need to run the email message past you so that you know they're not going to put their foot in it. But it seems to me that that's feasible. Do you think it's feasible, or is even that a burden, given if you've got 16 extension history students to run?
That is my advice, to email, find someone and try and...
Yeah.
But then again, as a person in your position, how much time have you got for a kid doing this sort of research?
Look, I think that's what we're paid to do. I would don't turn down requests from secondary students. I've never been in a position where I've had so many that I couldn't deal with them. And often it's... No secondary student that you've got, whose message you've looked at, will ask this person to do the research for them. They're not asking for knowledge. They're asking for advice. What do you think I should read, they'll say. And Geoffrey Blainey's Tyranny of Distance, do you think that's still relevant? It was published when my grandfather was alive. That kind of advice, which can help to put them, to nudge them in one direction or another. So that sort of response doesn't require work, because the scholar is right across the topic. It just requires them to sit down and write back for 5 minutes, and yet that five-minute message could make a huge difference to a kid in Ulla Dulla who really needs to know which 15 books they should read. I would imagine that's the kind of support that you guys need more than anything. Yeah. Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Right. Great. Fantastic. Okay. Deserves an A for sheer cheek. Yeah. Yeah. Spot on.
My kid wrote to Lindy Chamberlain.
Wow. Did you get a reply?
Yeah, it said, I can't help it at the stage.
Yeah, fair
and
enough.
She included the letter in her essay and replied saying, I'm unable to assist at this stage. She just wanted to comment on the display and on what Lindy Chamberlain actually thought of having become part of a popular culture.
Yep, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Hang on. Whoa. We've got a microphone. You have the conch.
Look, I was just going to respond from the point of view of a curator, which is what I am.
Yeah.
And places like the National Museum have systems. Like here, there's an email, and it's called Duty Curator. So it's curator at NMA.
Yeah.
And we get things. I used to work here. I don't anymore. You get requests like that all the time. From uni students, from other academics, from school students, and the most valuable advice, having been in the position of someone that receives those emails, is to make sure that they have an idea of what they want to know. We get so many emails going, basically, can you do my research for me? But you're more likely to get a really good and kind of considered response if they've thought it out.
Yes, absolutely.
But of course, like, it's a real priority for all museums of all sizes to help.
Yeah, as public institutions.
The major problem is going from a topic to a defined question.
To a question, yeah.
When you've got so many kids in your class, I can't go and do all the reading for every topic. But that is the difficult thing.
And make sure that they catch their approach in standard formal English, the text generation, which uses abbreviations all the time, that's all right for talking to their friends, but it creates a very bad impression if you approach somebody and, for example, don't include any capital letters in the message. It's a simple thing, but it's that kind of courtesy thing, which is the sort of stuff that students ought to be learning anyway. I'd agree. Framing the question is the real challenge. Mind you, can I suggest that there might be tricks here? As I think I said to someone this morning, that there's hardly any question that hasn't been asked before. I mean, although we want students to develop their own questions and pursue them in their own way, the chances are somebody's asked the same sort of question before, which means that, and you've got a curriculum, soon has a national curriculum that identifies issues and questions and themes. And it could well be that a question that works for a European history project this year will work very well with different nouns for an Australian history project next year. And we've already used some of those words, perceptions, for example. Now, we've agreed that going near the media is a bit of a problem, But the idea of arguments and issues and contested interpretations, those are things that are perennial through history. So the student may be hearing it for the first time, but you may be saying it for the 15th time, and you may be inclining them towards a question which you know works, but you've never seen it work for this particular topic before. But if it worked for Federation last year, it might just work for the origins of the First World War this year. Yeah, just an idea. I have to say, by way of intermission, that I'm not envious at all. I admire you guys. I started as a student teacher at Melba High School, where this student was this morning, at Melba High School in 1978, and I never worked as a teacher. And so I have a small insight into what you do, but only enough to know that I can never do it. So this is very much a counsel of perfection by somebody who isn't a practitioner. Anything else? I'm really interested to know what you think are topics that people want to pursue. Yes, you had a contribution, didn't you? Yeah. Yeah.
Only just that discussion about contacting people.
Yeah, keep going.
That's all. It was just probably the best response I ever had when I was in schools was... when we were looking into Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and I can't remember the archaeologist's name, but the students ended up having a conversation with him from site via Skype.
Wow.
So he's sitting there at a dusty table on a laptop with the backdrop, talking to students about what they're uncovering.
Yeah.
It was just, and quite happily did that, no dramas at all.
Yeah.
So it's just
that's right. People are flattered if you take an interest in them.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Mari. I think one of the things the students really struggle with is how historians work. How does history get constructed?
Mm.
They can't seem to see that that's a real thing that a working historian does and is still doing. And so I think it would be really good for them to hear from people going through that historical process and hearing about the variety of ways that it can happen as well, and making that real to them instead of just reading in a text that this is how someone did it 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So that would be a valuable...
How do you think we could do that? Because although we talk to individual students and supervisors, and part of that discussion often relates to why you're interested in something, I mean, this morning, again, just to draw on the most recent example, we were talking about the emotions that underlie people's belief in or non-acceptance of the idea of a battle for Australia. And in doing that, I obviously talked about the emotions of people who thought that there was a battle for Australia in 1942, but I also talked about the reason I have a belief in the opposite. It's not just a rational, evidence-based view. It's rooted in an emotion about, to put it bluntly, about the evils of Nazism. I mean, that sounds a bit roundabout, but the point is it was talking about the emotional basis. Now, I can do that individually, but how do you think we could do that on not the industrial scale you're working on, but if you've got 16 students, as you say, you can't do it for each one of them. Is there a way we can do that?
I think what they need to be linked with is a working historian. So maybe you could run a session where someone or two people in dialogue with each other talk about how they're doing their work.
Yeah.
And they'll allow the students to interact with questions, perhaps, just so they can hear about the process, how long it took, who helps me to do it, what financial support. You know, they need to understand how history happens.
Absolutely.
Or is recorded.
Can I make you an offer here? And David is a great medium for making this happen, but if you wanted to raise up a group of either teachers or students or both to do exactly that on an informal basis, you know, it doesn't have to be... I mean, if you come from Mulladulla, it's going to cost you money, but if you come from the other side of Canberra, it won't. I think that that would be the least service we could provide. Yeah.
Because that would be a really valuable thing for them to be part of.
And for both of us, to be honest, because when you talk about your work, you have to explain it. When you explain it, you realise things about it. So that would be of mutual benefit. So there's a promise. We'll do it. There was another one. Yes, Leonie.
Podcasts, or preferably vodcast, just you know, more visual, of working historians, perhaps interviews based on the extension history questions about who are the historians, how do historians work, what do you see as being the role of the historian.
Uh-huh.
So a series of currently working historians in Australia who the kids might even... my case study is women convicts in New South Wales.
Right.
And, you know, obviously a lot of those historians are easily accessible.
Mm.
If it was in your budgetary... plan for 2000 and whenever to look at doing that and putting them on your website, and so we could go to your website, click on the link, there's a little video of Sian Rees or whoever going chat, blah, 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 specifically structured to, without being too New South Wales
centred,
but those sorts of questions. So the general questions are, you know, what is the role of the historian, how does a historian work, the things that you were asking about before. So if you can't get to whatever session, that information was there for years to come.
Right. That's a great idea. Yeah. Wow. I've got some questions back, but
I think speaking as a curator here again, I think that sort of thing is available, but maybe just people aren't aware of it, and maybe it's not labelled as a podcast talking about what historians do. But I think that's one thing that the National Museum is particularly good at in general is curators talking about what they do, and there's a lot of information out there on the internet where people talk about specific exhibitions that they have put together and how they go about that, research into particular collections and objects. I think if students are encouraged to look at the publications related to particular museums, The Powerhouse and Historic Houses of Sydney are really good at having blogs and things where curators and historians actually talk about the work that they're currently doing and how they're going about it and the surprises that they have. I think that material is out there that, you know, maybe just people aren't aware of it.
Well, that relates to my question, because I wondered, does it have to be topic specific? I mean, for example, if... So it wouldn't matter... Right. So the method, regardless of topic, without being dry about it, because dry is death. Yeah. Okay. There was some... Yes.
I think that would be particularly useful because my kids are struggling with the same thing in just working out what question to ask or what series of questions to ask. They know they love, I don't know, the French Revolution, but that's sort of where it stops for them. Or they have one larger question and they don't know how to break it down. So something like that would be fantastic. And I know there is some stuff available. If you look on iTunes U, unis have just got so much stuff out there and I find that really useful. But may I suggest for people like myself who are in Sydney, who it's probably not feasible to bring four kids down here to see a lecture or a discussion forum, maybe if we could get a video conference set up via Skype or whichever way you care to do it, even if it's at just one school in Sydney or even maybe one of the unis or museums in Sydney, and I guess maybe HTA can open that up in some sense and then makes it easier and accessible for us.
Of course, there's already a structure of HTNSW which has that annual conference, doesn't it? So I'm not suggesting there isn't any structure at the moment.
I can certainly just follow up on that very specific point that we have video conference facilities here. So we can, you know, we don't have to have everyone physically here. We can talk about that at the end.
Other concerns? Yeah.
From an HTA point of view, we're looking at how to use... what in New South Wales, basically, people may not know, is the connected classrooms. So we've got facility to use that, which we could link up with the video conferencing and then beam to all schools simultaneously at one time. So that's certainly possible.
Yeah. Other strands of concern or things you desperately want people to help on?
You asked the question before about being topic specific.
Yeah.
And I think because of the diversity of topics that our kids do as their research project, and then because of the diversity of case studies that we all do, that work we were talking about or asking about with the historians' work and those more general sort of concepts about historiography, I think would be the most valuable and the most widely accessed because you're not focusing on, okay, you know, let's just look at this particular aspect of Australian history. One child might choose to do that for a project, 20,000 others might not.
Because I think there are principles and methods and concepts that run right through so that, if it doesn't have to be limited.
Schools of historical thought. So your postmodernism, your post-postmodernism, your pre-postmodernism.
Can I ask whether you think it's worthwhile exposing students to that degree of theory?
In the syllabus. They have to do. Jeez. They have to be able to talk about. I recommend. Others might disagree, but I like to prepare my kids with four schools of historical thought. So I do the Enlightenment historians, I do the postmodernist historians.
Yeah.
Depending on kids' interests, we might do Christian historians and usually one other just thrown in there just so they can talk about the progression of... It's highly theoretical.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that our kids do grapple with. And that's... It's pretty heavy going.
Yeah. See, this is what worries me, that I'm not suggesting that they ought to do something really basic to begin with, because bright kids will cotton on to quite advanced things, given enthusiasm and native intelligence and example and so on. But I'd be really wary of exposing any Year 12 student to postgraduate.
You don't do it too early. I tend to do it in about term three, and by the time they're actually capable of. Uh-huh. You don't want to freak them out too soon.
No, quite. Or put them off, more to the point.
It is a fantastic history. Well, they're doing it in English
and
subjects.
Right.
Sorry, yeah. I'm just commenting on the fact that they will do those concepts in English and art.
Yeah.
So you're just building on some knowledge they may already have.
Yeah.
And they have to have that understanding to be able to argue conceptually when they're writing on their essays.
Yeah.
You have to demonstrate it.
My younger daughter's doing year 12 at the moment, and I'm often astonished at the level that she's expected to work at, which is far and away above anything that fifth year matric in South Australia in 1974, you know, it's just primitive by comparison. But again, that puts more expectations onto you as well as onto them. I think it's a terribly tough act to pull off.
That this is a course that introduces them to first year university. They're really well prepared for historiography.
Yeah.
And they get that feedback from lecturers all the time.
I got introduced to first year history and first year history, though. Yeah.
That's the unique thing about this.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how much time we've got left, but can I say that from the point of view of people who practice within institutions, who have much more leisure and time and facilities and resources to pursue research abundantly, poaching on their time, never feel bad at approaching somebody who's paid off the public purse to get your share of them. And I mean, I may be setting up a rod for my own back here, but really, it's no trouble to share the expertise that we have. And as Rowan said, curators do this as a matter of course. Historians, good historians, do it as a matter of course too. So, if I don't leave you with any substantive ideas, I'd like to leave you with an impression of openness. But we've got time a bit. No, have we or not? I don't know. Okay.
I'm just wondering, without it becoming
something you feel you have to rattle off. But I don't know how other people feel. But I think it would be great to get more of a sense of why a Centre for Historical Research at the National Museum. You know, the museum started without one.
Yeah, okay.
And maybe just a little bit of a snapshot of the breadth of work going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, perhaps relating that again to the stuff that's happening here.
Sure, actually that's good. I hadn't thought of an advert, but that's a great way to put it. The museum, as you know, has been going for 30 years this year, in the sense that its act was passed in 1980, and it's been on this site since 2001, so it's 9 years old this month. By the time it had been going for 6 or 7 years, it was pretty clear that this museum was a great success. It was building a collection, it had opened a building, it had very active collecting and exhibition policies, it had tremendous public programs and education policies. Everything seemed to be in place. In 2006, though, Craddock Morton, our late director, he left last week. Craddock looked around and asked the question, what does a great museum do? And he ticked off the boxes. And almost everything that a great museum did, the National Museum was doing. The one thing it wasn't doing and didn't have time or resources to do was research, deep research. There was lots of research being done to develop and acquire and display the collection. But as Rowan will testify, that didn't leave much time for much else. So in 2006, the museum resolved to set up a Centre for Historical Research, which brought in, and whether or not this was the right decision or not, I'm still uncertain of, but it brought into the museum a number of researchers in different ways. For example, we did a deal with ANU and got two academics in 6 months about. So there's ways of building up expertise very rapidly and relatively cheaply, in the sense that we didn't have to pay for two academics' brains full time. But we built up a staff of about 10 in this new Centre for Historical Research, some of whom were existing members of staff, a couple of curators came in, some of whom were appointed from outside, like me, some of whom were appointed on contract, like Maria Nugent and Jenny Newell, an Indigenous Studies specialist and a Pacific specialist, and Daryl Lewis, to finish the trio, a Pastoral North specialist. So these people began to research, and they were specifically not asked to develop and display collections, which meant that they could focus, if you like, on their scholarly expertise and on disseminating insights from the museum to the broader community. Now, again, whether or not that actually wasn't the right way to go, and we've modified practice since. So, for example, the centre brings in curators into the centre now who work on projects that relieve them from their curatorial duties and who work on books or substantial products. So it's developing a research culture within the museum, and there's a lot more interchange than there was when the centre began. But the range of expertise that those people exhibit really reflects on the breadth of the museum's interests. So starting in no special order, we've got Mike Smith, whose idea the centre was, who's an archaeologist of deep time. So the next time somebody tells you that Aborigines have inhabited this continent for 60,000 years, it was down to Mike Smith to do that fundamental dating work to establish that sort of benchmark. And Mike's doing a big history of human occupation of the Australian desert at the moment. So there'll be a big book coming out probably next year. We've got, and we had Indigenous specialists. We had Maria Nugent and Shino Kanishi, who are both poached by the National Centre for Indigenous Studies, which at least tells us we recruited the right people. But they've gone off. So actually, we don't have a very strong expertise within the centre in Indigenous history. Really, the only survivor of that is Margot Neal, who's sort of the centre, but she doesn't work within it. So Indigenous history, which was going to be one of our strong strands when we began, is now less strong. What's taken its place, really, is environmental history. And virtually everybody in the centre is interested either in straight environmental history or in environmental and social history. So that bushfire project that I'm doing, it's principally social history because it's looking at the people affected by the fire in February last year in one tiny bit of Victoria. But it's also environmental because it clearly relates to a recurrent environmental disaster that strikes the southeast of this continent regularly. And we've got other people within the centre who are primarily environmental historians. Libby Robin, one of those ANU people, who's one of the prime environmental historians in the country. And we've got Nick Brown, who's basically does everything, but he's really interested in environmental history too. So we've spread our expertise not in every single area. For example, colonial social history is not very prominent in our program, and we're mostly doing colonial social history through the unpaid associates who come to us, because now people come to us and say, we'd like to work with you. And we say, yes, of course, we'll give you a desk. And they get the desk, and we get the benefit of their brain, if you like. So it's a fair trade. But they're working in, some of them are working in colonial social history. So we can't work in every field, but what we can do is work across the main areas of the museum's interests, with the significant exception of Indigenous history, but our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander program, our curatorial colleagues, are strong in that area, so we don't feel that the museum as a whole is deficient. It's just where that expertise falls. I guess that the hallmark of the work we do, we're very much seeing ourselves as public historians, which is why I'm saying to you, contact me by all means. Although we're all academically trained or academically oriented, because we're public historians working in a public history museum, there's a very strong sense of engagement with the wider community in all sorts of ways. So it's a kind of a hybrid within the museum, but the benefits of it can be seen not just in the books we produce, but also in the contacts we make through the academic and the publishing and the popular, the media community, and also, of course, in this education sphere. Is that fair enough, Spran? Yeah. Anything to round off?
Is there anything coming out of that description that you want to ask you about? Do you have student placements?
Yes, we do, actually. We have an internship program, which is principally carried out through the ANU's Museums and Collections course, but we also have opportunities for what we call private interns. If someone can get themselves to Canberra for a month or whatever, we're very happy to find a spot. We coordinate internships within the museum. So If tertiary students, we sometimes have secondary work experience students, but to be honest, they're not much use. Sometimes year 12 girls are really good in the sense that they're disciplined and focused and they've got sufficient historical skill to be useful. Year 11 boys, absolutely hopeless. You know that. So we do have placements, and if there are education students, we can sometimes find placements for them. Internships are hard to organise because you've got to convince somebody else to give up time to supervise them. Invariably, they don't work within the centre, but I'm open to that too. So if any students want to work in historical research, we can find a spot for you. But, yeah, basically, we're here as a facilitator of that kind of experience.
Because I was just interested in what you were saying about the research on the bushfires. Mm. Does that mean that eventually there'll be a display in the museum?
Ah, there already has been. Yeah, we did our curatorial colleagues are simultaneously collecting in a relatively small way, because the Victorian bushfires, there's been a bit of a concordat between the Museum Victoria and the National Museum. It's recognised being essentially a Victorian event. So Museum Victoria has put an awful lot of energy into collecting and documenting that tragedy, the disaster, last year, and we put a relatively small amount of energy into it, but we did collect stuff, and there was a display in the hall on the first anniversary. Not very big. But this is where the beauty of the curatorial and the historical research duality comes in, because the way in which we got involved in the bushfire research was that a community group in Steeles Creek, which is north of Yarra Glen, contacted one of our colleagues at ANU, in the Centre for Environmental History, who now has a formal relationship with our centre, and invited us down to help them recover from the fire. And they saw recovery not just in physical terms, you know, restoring creek banks and trees and fences. They saw recovery in intangible terms, in understanding the history of the community and understanding what had happened to them on the 7th of February 2009. So the museum, reaching out from Canberra in a way that isn't connected to collecting. Because when I go down to Steeles Creek, I don't root around people's backyards and come back with charred bits of stuff and say, here, see what I brought you, curator. Curators have got their own program for that. But what I come back with is tape recordings and documents and understanding, so I can write a book which interprets that environmental social event as a manifestation of the recent history of modern Australia. So I think it's working in a really useful, complementary way. And I forgot what the question was, but it seemed like a really good answer.
It was a fantastic answer. Thank you.
Any more final questions?
All right.
Peter, we might leave it at
sure.
that, but thank
Look, can
you.
Can I just say thank you? I admire the work you do, and I'm really happy to help. And that promise of us doing something to talk about methodology in some form is a genuine one. Okay.
Thank you for winging it.
Okay.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.